For many Christians, what we're doing tonight is a big mistake. Maybe you're going to think that as well. And I'm talking here about good people, okay? Bible-believing evangelicals, Christians passionate about mission, people wanting to teach the Bible. For many such people, to spend an evening on this whole topic of creation and evolution is a mistake, because it's to dig up what they would see as an old debate, something that's dated. They would say it's a debate we need to move on from because it's terribly divisive. We don't want to set Christians against each other, you know, and surely does it really matter how long those days were? Why make such a big deal of it? They would see it as serving as a distraction from the gospel. You know, we want to talk about what Jesus has done, his death on the cross, and instead we end up with a discussion all about dinosaurs and dating, and also how old things are. Anyone awake?
Yeah.
Okay. And they might also say that to take a creationist position is an apologetic disaster, in that we're trying to reach the world, we've got enough, we're seen as a bit crazy anyway as Christians, we've got enough problems as we are, so why on earth bring in this whole creation stuff, which really makes us appear as total lunatics, people that would seem to be rejecting rationality itself. That is what a lot of Christians will think, and maybe that's where some of you are coming from tonight. Maybe some of you are just very confused by the whole debate, don't really know what to think. Or you've been at university and you know, you would expect to get opposition from maybe atheists, but you discover that actually some of the biggest problems almost seem to come from other Christians. And how do you deal with that, with Christians that disagree with you on this topic? So what we're going to do tonight is look at an approach that is probably a little bit different to what you've heard before. And I think it will make it pretty obvious why it matters what we believe on this, and why it is anything but a distraction from the gospel. And also, I think I want it to help you if you think, well, look, I've got nothing to say on this. I'm not a scientist. I don't understand genetics. I don't understand all this sort of stuff. I don't know anything about dinosaurs, okay? If you've got questions about that, I'm not the man for that. You don't need to be a scientist. I hope what you'll get from tonight is that actually there is a way you can approach this topic without having to deal with any science at all. And perhaps if you're as well coming tonight as someone that maybe is very sceptical about what the Bible teaches on origins, I want to leave you with perhaps the thought that you actually have some big problems of your own in where you are coming from on this. So the focus tonight is on what the Bible teaches. If we have a bit of time at the end, I can say a little bit about how we approach the sort of scientific issues. But inevitably, whenever I give talks on this sort of thing, the questions are always about stuff I've never said anything about. So we'll see what happens. Now, one reason why this topic matters is that you can't avoid it. People ask questions on this. Why is that? Why is this such a common topic? Why is it so often we will get questions about this? And why do people get so passionate about it? Why are the science programs that get high viewing figures, the science books that sell well, the ones about origins? Brian Cox, if he was doing a series on statistical thermodynamics, I don't think he would get particularly good viewing figures, even though it's Brian Cox. Okay, people are interested in this topic of origins. Why? Because they want to know where they came from, because origins shapes our identity. It shapes who we are. Where we've come from tells us something about who I am. That's why people are so precious about national history. You know, if you mix up their history of their nation and what happened in different wars, they get very offended, because it's shaping their own national identity. And in a similar way, evolutionary history shapes our identity as human beings. This is what says about the Brian Cox series a few years ago. Professor Brian Cox reveals how the most fundamental scientific principles and laws explain not only the story of the universe, but the story of us all. Do you see what it's saying there? That what who we are, our story, is explained by this whole bigger story of where everything has come from. And they're using that word story, and I'm going to use that word story because I think it's a very helpful to speak of evolution and creation as a story. It is a story of life. Now, some Christians get upset with this because story is always seen as being something sort of fictional. I'm not saying whether something is fictional or not. I simply mean story in the sense of a narrative, something that pulls together different facts, different observations in a coherent way. Has a beginning, a middle, and an end, if you like. And evolution is a story in that sense. It's pulling together stuff about what's going on in genomes and fossils and distributions of animals into a simple, single narrative. And if we are going to talk about evolution as a story, I think it helps to make clear we're talking about the big story, what I've called the goo to you via the zoo. So we're talking about the big thing of how, if you like, people have come from amoeba over a long period of time by entirely natural processes. We're not talking about the way organisms can change a bit over time. Organisms can change a lot. New species can form. Many Christians say new species never form. That's rubbish. New species can form. Bacteria evolve drug resistance. These things happen. There's lots of change. That's not what's in dispute here. The issue is the big story. And you can sum up that big story in three words: life made itself. And in fact, because of the confusion over the word evolution, I tend to prefer just to refer to it as the life made itself story, because that is what it is saying. It is saying just the normal processes of physics and chemistry, reproducing organisms, are sufficient to explain everything that we see today. So how does that compare with the Bible story? Well, the Bible also gives a history of the world that you can summarise in different ways. Here I've got these four words: creation, fall, redemption, restoration. It's a narrative that takes us from the original creation to the new creation. It speaks of how God made the world, how he made human beings as his image to rule over the world, how we've rebelled against God, we've fallen, but God has come to rescue us through the work of his son, Jesus Christ, through his death and resurrection, and that he's coming back again to restore the world. And what I want to do tonight is to compare the Bible story with the evolution story. And as soon as we do that, we see that this whole creation-evolution debate is about something much more than the interpretation of one chapter of the Bible, namely Genesis 1, or even one word in that chapter, the word day. We're talking about doctrine that's taught all the way through Scripture. That is why it's important, and that's also why it gives us great opportunities in evangelism. So how can we compare these two stories? Evolution is a scientific account of Earth history. The Bible is not a scientific textbook, or at least not of modern science. So how on earth can you use the Bible to assess a modern scientific theory? And those Christians I was speaking at the beginning would argue that maybe the Bible and evolution are telling the same story. It's just that one's told in a scientific language, the other in a theological language. I don't think that works, because there are a number of points at which these two stories intersect. And we're going to focus on one of those, and it's the issue of physical death. The Bible talks lots about physical death, and it's also something that's part of the evolution story. Here, the two stories are talking about the same thing. So we can compare directly how these two stories compare. And in the evolution story, death has always been present. Physical death, disease, decay processes are the way the world is, the way the world has always been. You can dig up dinosaur fossils that suffered brain tumours. This has been the way of the world since the beginning in the evolution story. It's interesting that Darwin was deeply affected by the loss of his 10-year-old daughter. But in the story that he had, there's nothing unusual about that. There have always been daughters of creatures who have died prematurely. That's just a fact of life, part of nature. Water's wet, objects fall to the ground, people and creatures die in horrible ways. That is just part of the fabric of the universe, and in fact it's essential to the evolutionary process. In contrast, the Bible story says physical death and the suffering associated with it have come from human sin. In other words, it's an unnatural intrusion into the world. Now, I'm going to explain that in some detail tonight. But notice what I've done so far. I've reduced all the sort of messy complexity of the creation-evolution debate to two options, to two stories that focus on the issue of death. One where death is always present, one where death is an anomaly. It's come through human sin. So in fact, you can dispense with these labels creation and evolution, which have all sorts of different meanings in people's heads, and just refer to these two positions with respect to death. And when I'm talking about death, I'm also going to lump in some other things too. I'm going to include disease and suffering. I'm talking about the sort of disease that leads to death, and I'm talking about suffering in the sense of agony, i.e. pain that is far beyond what's needed to warn of danger. You could argue that some limited pain is a good thing, but I'm talking about agony. And I'm going to focus on human physical death, but I will say a little bit about animal death later on. And what we're going to be doing is comparing two possible versions of the Bible's story. One where death comes through sin, and one where death has always been present. In other words, this bottom one will be a version, if you like, of the Bible story that we're trying to sort of adapt the Bible to make it consistent with the evolution story. This is what you would need to do to the Bible story, if you like, to make it consistent with the evolution, death always present story. And I think you'll see as we do this why, A, this doesn't work, you end up with something that's incoherent, and also why these things really matter. So we're going to be having these two diagrams coming up a lot tonight, where we're looking at change in the created order. Both of these have Jesus' death and resurrection in the centre. If you like, they both agree on the solution. Where they disagree on is what the problem is. What is it that the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is solving? They have a different understanding of the story. And we're going to focus on the middle first, then we're going to look at the beginning of the story, and then the end of the story. So, everything depends on where you begin. The central question of the creation-evolution debate is the days, dinosaurs, dating, DNA. No, it's none of those. So if you think that's the wrong way to think about this topic, and you will get the wrong answer. It's about why did Jesus have to die? That is actually what this debate is all about. And if you get that, everything else flows, okay? This is the point that people get wrong. Why do I say that? Well, Jesus said himself that he must suffer and die. Not that it was an option, he must suffer and die. And clearly talking about physical death in that context. In other words, he saw that as the solution. So if you're going to argue from the sort of solution to what the problem is, that suggests that physical death was part of the problem. It was part of the punishment for sin. Now, Jesus's suffering included more than physical death. He suffered what we might call spiritual death. On the cross, he talks about being forsaken by his Father in judgment on our sin. But if you were to argue that sin has only brought spiritual death into the world, then Jesus could have suffered that spiritual death on the cross. He could have said it is finished, come down from the cross alive, and still purchased our salvation. If you're saying that physical death hasn't come from sin, then presumably that is how Jesus could have solved the problem. Suffered that spiritual death, come down from the cross alive. Problem is, that doesn't fit with what we're told in the Bible. So often, the Bible points to the necessity of Jesus' physical suffering to pay the price of sin. And here's just a few examples. But now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree. By his wounds you have been healed. Sins in his body. You have been holy, made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And the famous confession of the church, 1 Corinthians 15:3. For what I received, I passed on to you as a first importance that Christ died. And he has to be talking there about the fact that Jesus physically died on a cross. That's the historical event he's talking about. He died for our sins according to the scriptures. Didn't die because Pilate put him there. He died for our sins. And when you think about it, what are we doing when we celebrate the Lord's Supper? We're affirming the physical suffering and death of Christ in connection with payment for sin. The bread and the wine are symbols of a broken body and shed blood. It's terribly physical. And I think one of the things actually we often do is spiritualize everything too much. The Bible is far more physical and earthy than we recognize sometimes. It's a very physical book, and Jesus' death was a very physical thing. Very gruesome thing. So, like we've been told there it's about Jesus' death, we're told the logic of it too. Romans 5:12, sin entered the world through one man, that was Adam, and death through sin. And in this way, death came to all men because all sinned. If you look at the context of that passage, Paul is certainly talking about physical death. He's talking about more than physical death, but he certainly is including physical death in what he is talking about. So he's saying physical death has come through sin. It's even clearer in this verse, 1 Corinthians 15:21. For since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead comes also through a man. Notice what Paul is doing there. He's using the storyline of the Bible. He's thinking about what happened at the beginning with Adam, and he's saying there's a correspondence with what went wrong with Adam, the death that came through Adam, and the solution that comes through Christ. The problem and the solution are linked together in the story of the Bible. So can this death be something purely sort of spiritual, that we're just sort of cut off from God? Well, it can't be, because if we believe anything about the resurrection, it's that it's about a new physical life. Jesus' body physically came back to life. That must correspond to the physical death that comes through Adam's sin. Isn't that what we sing? See what a morning. Death is dead, love has won, Christ has conquered. Well, what has he conquered? Well, most basically, the resurrection is a victory over physical death. Death is the last enemy. But think of this. If you say death has always been present, you've got a real problem. Because you find the very centre of the Christian story, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, becomes a massive contradiction. Because we find the hero of the story, Jesus, comes to conquer an enemy he made at the beginning. Because if he made the world with death in place at the beginning, why is he now coming along to conquer it? That just doesn't make sense. It doesn't work as a story. You end up with the problem that the cross and resurrection do not make sense as a solution to the problem of sin. You can say the same thing about issues of disease and agony. Remember, Jesus talked about needing to suffer and to die. I think it's very significant that Jesus wore a crown of thorns. It's interesting, he sweated in the garden of Gethsemane, sweated blood. Why did those things happen? They weren't simply reflecting the fact that he was a human being. They were part of normal human experience. In doing that, he was bearing part of the curse from which he would rescue us. Well, think of Jesus' healing miracles. Think of the way he healed people with leprosy, blindness, paralysis, demon possession. Were those things part of the original creation? Which is what you have to say if the evolution story is correct. in that case, the story becomes incoherent because Jesus is now like a bad architect trying to undo his original design. He's made the world with leprosy and blindness and all this stuff in place, and now he's coming along and trying to fix it all. That's a rubbish architect. Instead, what we're told is that the healing miracles are all part of the redemption from sin. They're all part of the penalty of sin. Many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases. Those problems in the world were linked to sin, and that is why the answer is Jesus' death. We're also told our bodies need to be redeemed. We're groaning inwardly as we wait for the adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. We need new bodies. Why? Because sin has messed up our physical bodies. Again, there's a connection between the problem and the solution. So why did Jesus have to die? Because physical death was part of the punishment for sin. In other words, death has not always been present. And actually, that's an argument I've made entirely from the New Testament. In other words, it doesn't depend on what you think the literary genre of Genesis 1 to 3 is. You get bogged down in endless arguments about that. You don't need to worry about that stuff. Now, I think Genesis is teaching all this very clearly, and that is why the New Testament teaches what it does, because it gets it from the Old Testament. But it's all just there for you in the New Testament. You don't have to be some expert in ancient Near East literature or something. It's all there for you. And it's something that's actually just assumed through the Bible. I could give you countless examples like this. It's just almost one at random. The book of Samuel, the people said to Samuel, "Pray to the Lord your God for your servants so that we will not die," as in physically die. "For we've added to all our other sins the evil of asking for a king." In other words, we've sinned, we're liable to death. They seem to be very clear that there was a connection between physical death and their sin. There's no footnote here in the book of Samuel saying, "Oh, by the way, we're not really going to get this, but you see, they had this idea that physical death was connected to sin." It's obvious. The writers don't need to do that, because if you've read the thing from the beginning, it's perfectly clear physical death is connected to sin. And it's just assumed through the Bible. What about the start of the story? In this version here, death through sin, when God says the creation is very good, he means that it's free of sin, it's free of death, it's free of agony. All of those things have entered as a result of human sin. In other words, we're the villains of the story. We've brought the terrible weight of suffering into the world. God is the hero of the story, who sends Jesus to rescue us and the whole of the suffering creation. If, on the other hand, death has always been present, you get something very different. You're now saying that God made the world replete with agony, disease, and death. That is how God chose to make it of his own sovereign free choice. In other words, God is the author of all suffering. Not that suffering is the God-ordained consequence of human sin, but that God made it like that at the beginning. So to quote an example that's often been made by David Attenborough, you'll hear it from Stephen Fry in a moment, you have to say that God used the evolutionary process to make parasitic worms that only live in the eyeballs of human beings and cause blindness. That God surveys that sort of creation with those sorts of things present, full of suffering, and declares with satisfaction, "You know what, this creation I've made is just so good." That is what you have to say. Now, some people say, well, you know, this word "good," we need to be careful with this. It means well crafted. It's been well made. So God is a master craftsman and he's done a good job. Well, there's lots of problems with this. One very trivial problem is that God would appear to be a very poor craftsman if he creates a world with infertility when his command is to go and multiply. That doesn't seem to quite add up. A bigger problem is this one that you've made God the craftsman of agony and brain tumours. So, for example, you could say a gas chamber is very good. It's been brilliantly made, brilliantly designed. But I'm not sure that's quite the way we are meant to understand how God made the creation at the beginning. You're left with a big moral problem if that is what you're saying good means. Other people say, well, look, suffering is sort of essential to life. If you're going to have life, suffering and death is just an inevitable part of that. It's a sort of downside you can't avoid. It's a price worth paying. You could maybe argue that, I think, if we were talking about very limited suffering. But I think the sheer weight of suffering makes that very difficult to sustain. Just think of the suffering that you know about amongst people you know. And then think, multiply that by all the people in the world, and then multiply that across all of history, and then add into that all the suffering in the animal kingdom. That's an awful lot of suffering we're talking about. And I don't think we can say that's a price worth paying. So if you take this line that death has always been present, you're left with this big apologetic problem, because God is the author of all suffering. And the sort of creation position I would advocate has plenty of difficulties, plenty of scientific problems, but I would argue those are actually rather small compared to this one. And of course, it's a very pastoral problem, isn't it? Do you really want to have to tell people suffering with terrible diseases that this was all part of a world that God called very good? And what do you say at a funeral? How can death be an enemy if it's what he made at the beginning and called very good? And just for you to get a feel of just how practical and relevant this is, we're going to look at a clip of Stephen Fry. And there's something, it's pretty offensive, this, okay? But I want you to have a think, where's he going wrong? And how would you respond?
In spite of your protestations, suppose it's all true, and you walk up to the pearly gates and you are confronted by God, what will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
I will basically, what's known as theology, I think I'll say, bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? That's what I'm saying.
And you think you're going to get in?
I don't know. But I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to get in on his terms. They're wrong. Now, if I died and it was Pluto, Hades, and if it was the 12 Greek gods, then I would have more trouble, because the Greeks were... they didn't pretend not to be human in their appetites and in their capriciousness and in their unreasonableness. They didn't present themselves as being all-seeing, all-wise, all-kind, all-beneficent. Because the God who created this universe, if it was created by God, is quite clearly a maniac. Utter maniac. Totally selfish. Totally. We have to spend our life on our knees thanking him? What kind of God would do that? Yes, the world is very splendid, but it also has in it insects whose whole life cycle is to burrow into the eyes of children and make them blind. They eat outwards from the eyes. And why? Why did you do that to us? You could easily have made a creation which that didn't exist. It is simply not acceptable. So, you know, atheism is not just about not believing there is a God, but on the assumption there is one. What kind of God is he? It's perfectly apparent that he is monstrous, utterly monstrous, and deserves no respect whatsoever. The moment you banish him, your life becomes simpler, purer, cleaner, more worth living, in my opinion.
That sure is the longest answer to that question that I've ever got in this entire series.
Okay, what would you say to Stephen Fry? Right, so what you've brought in there is what we've been talking through tonight, but actually God didn't make the world like that at the beginning. So if you like, he's got God wrong, isn't he? Any other thoughts on what he does there? Yeah, thank you. Isn't it it's very striking just how passionate he is about this. That's not right. Says who? On what basis is it not right? Why is suffering in some terrible way any worse than having a happy time? You may personally not want that, but what's that got to do with anything? If all you are is this product of a blind process, who cares what you think? Who cares what happens to us? There's no meaning, there's no purpose, there's no good, there's no evil. There's no moral standard, if you like, to judge God by. Not that we ever could in any case. So it's actually completely, for an intelligent man, it's completely up the twist what he's saying. But you can see that if you're saying, well, actually, God did make the world with all that in place, you've got a bit of a problem if you're going to talk to Stephen Fry. And many Christians run away from this issue because they think we can't challenge the scientists. But I'm far more concerned about how we're able to answer people like Stephen Fry, because that is actually the key question people have. And we can deal with the science in other ways. So, in a way, it's the whole character of God is at stake, isn't it? So much of apologetics today is not so much does some sort of God exist, but who is that God? What is that God like? People's attacks are very much about the character of God. And if we're going to deal with that, we've got to get creation right. So let's just move on to the end of the story, the new creation. In the death through sin version of the story, we're saying that creation itself needs to be rescued. That human sin has affected creation in such a way that creation needs to be redeemed. And again, this is exactly what the Bible teaches. Through him, through Christ, to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. If you read the whole passage, he makes all things. So all things includes all of creation. Now, if all things need to be reconciled, need to be rescued in some way, then all things must have been spoilt or damaged in some way by sin. And that's exactly what we're told in Romans 8. For the creation was subjected to frustration. That's actually using a word from the account of the flood. We'll maybe come back to that later. Not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in the hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. It is not talking about people there. It is talking about the rest of creation. And what Paul says there is something that he doesn't really bother to explain, because he thinks it should be fairly obvious if you've read the rest of the Bible. And you find stacks of examples of this throughout the Old Testament, of where creation, changes in creation, are linked to human sin. I'm not going to go through all of these, don't worry, but the most obvious one is Noah's flood. Why on earth does God send a flood? If the problem is human sin, just wipe out humans, send a plague or something. Why a flood that destroys the rest of creation? Well, the answer that we're given in, come back to that later, actually. The answer we're given in Genesis is that the earth was corrupt. The whole world was included in the flood because the whole world needed recreation. And actually, we totally miss this. One of the big, what's the big theological message of the flood? We'd probably say judgment on sin. Well, that is part of it, but we get that in lots of other parts of the Bible too. The big theological message of the flood is recreation. That God's promise of salvation is not just for souls, but for the whole of creation. That he's remaking the world in the flood. That is a picture of what God is going to do at the end of time. That is what is going on in the flood story. It's about recreation. Because the world needs to be changed. And let me just give you the example here in Jeremiah. Because again, this connection between problem in creation and human sin is just assumed. Talking about the Israelites, they pour out drink offerings to other gods to provoke me to anger, i.e. they're sinning. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, my anger and my wrath will be poured out on this place, on man, well, that makes sense. They're the ones that are the idolaters. They're the ones that are consciously sinful. But his anger is poured out on beast. You think, well, what have they done? They haven't made any idols. On the trees of the field, on the fruit of the ground. And it will burn and not be quenched. What on earth is going on? There's no footnote explaining. This is obvious. Human sin has consequences on the rest of creation. Interesting to think why that is. One reason, I think, is the fact that as human beings we are kings over creation, so what happens to us affects the creation we are kings over. But also that we are physically connected to creation. We are part of creation. We're not just souls, we're bodies. We are part of the created order. So there's this assumption of this link between human sin and creation, which is why we need this restoration of creation. Let's just finally look at what happens if death is always present. What happens to the story then? Well, now, why do we sort of need a new creation? This isn't part of a problem. This isn't a solution to a problem caused by sin, because they would say sin has an affected creation. Sin is just a spiritual problem between us and God. You know, creation was made with all of this bad stuff in place. So you're really saying that this new creation is something that God was always going to do, something the original creation was sort of progressing to, whether we'd sinned or not. So this new creation is just the answer to a sort of pretty shoddy initial creation. You know, God did a pretty poor job at the beginning, and so he's going to sort it out at the end in a new creation. That's how the story has to work. And of course, that's a bit of a nonsense of a story, isn't it? Because God is no longer that hero who cleans up our mess, but he's the God who decides to make a world with bad things like death in place, and later makes a similar physical world. Remember, the new creation is a physical world without such things. And it means that the cross is no longer really relevant to this story. Yes, we need Jesus' death to bring about our own personal forgiveness and reconciliation. But the cross has got no relevance to the suffering of creation, because that's got nothing to do with sin. And so actually, in terms of the story of creation, as opposed to simply human souls, the cross has no place at all. It has no connection to the intrinsic suffering of creation. So your understanding of the cross is pretty radically different, depending on what you believe on origins. It is only if you say that there is a connection between sin and creation that it makes sense to say that the new creation is part of salvation. So we can say it matters for this reason. What's at stake? Well, the gospel is at stake. This is not some debate about what the literary genre of Genesis 1 is. It's about what's the gospel, what's the cross all about. And that's a really good news when it comes to evangelism, because it means if you're going to deal with questions on origins, you cannot but talk about the gospel. It actually leads us to a great opportunity. I've managed to appear on the telly a number of occasions. You don't have very long to say anything, but on each occasion I have talked about the cross, because I couldn't explain my position without doing so. So it's not that I was talking about dinosaurs one moment and then sort of, oh, by the way, I must tell you that Jesus died for your sins on the cross, because I'm on the telly. I couldn't explain what I believed about creation without talking about what Jesus did. So this idea that this debate is some sort of distraction from the gospel is complete nonsense. It's a wonderful entry point to the gospel. So it means you can talk to your friends. You may not have the scientific stuff, but you can say, well, let me tell you what I believe about death, what I believe about suffering in the world. Let's compare that to where you are coming from. It gives us a great opening. Now, this is what's at stake. Well, there's actually a lot more at stake. Tonight, we've really looked at this first one, no agony before Adam. The whole issue of Adam being a historical person, and more than that, the physical ancestor of all humanity is of enormous significance, both for the theology of the Bible, but for that very reason, actually, for all sorts of issues we face today, how we've been made. Flood is a global catastrophe. I've alluded a little bit to that. That has massive theological importance in the storyline of the Bible. If you want to... there's an article in these... Copies of Origins are all free, but there's an article in there that says a little bit more about the theology of the flood. If you want to look at that, it should be on our, when our new website goes up in the next couple of weeks, you should be able to get it from there too. So all of that is in a chapter in the book Debating Darwin that I wrote a few years ago. Also has various people. You can see how people trashed me after that as well. It was a debate, so you can see what people said against what I was saying in that book. But what I'm trying to get across is that there's an awful lot going on with this topic, and we've only actually just looked at a small bit of it. Let me just, yeah, and there's some more references about Adam and stuff. Right, so far I've talked about human death. I just want to say something very briefly about animal death, because it helps us to bring together where the sort of science comes in here. I think simply the argument about human death is enough for us to have to reject the big story of evolution. But some people would say, yeah, fair enough what you're saying about human death, but animal death is different. I don't think we can actually separate the two very easily. And I think the Bible actually says a lot about animals. One of my... sort of pet hates, if you like, is the way that we ignore loads of the Bible because we say, oh, that's boring, oh, that's irrelevant, that doesn't matter. You know, the Bible says loads about animals. Have you ever looked at that? Have you ever thought about why? Have you ever thought about what the significance of that is? You know, it's like the genealogies. We think, oh, that doesn't matter. It's crucial. If we're going to evangelize today, we need to understand genealogies. There's all sorts of stuff in the Bible we ignore that is actually going to be increasingly important in our evangelism. And animals are one of them. Now, in the flood story, we are told that God didn't just want to get rid of human beings. I will blot out from the earth the human beings I've created, people together with animals and creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry I have made them, i.e. the animals, the creeping things as well. I'm sorry I've made them. Why? Surely that must mean something has gone wrong. Something has changed. Why would you be sorry about that? And we're told that God saw the earth was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted its ways on the earth. By the way, you don't get this in the NIV. It changes it to sort of humans. But this isn't actually what the text says. It does say all flesh, and all flesh is defined for us later on in the passage in a number of places. All flesh includes birds, domestic animals, wild animals, swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all human beings, okay? So it's more than just human beings. And all flesh had corrupted its way on the earth. The earth is filled with violence because of them. So animals are violent. God is concerned the fact that creation is now full of violent animals. Something has changed. That is why God brings this judgment that affects the animals as well as the human beings. In other words, yes, it's human beings that sin. Animals are not sinful. They're not consciously disobeying God. And yet, they are bound up in this whole curse upon sin. And that is made explicit for us in the text. And it's not just in the flood story. Have you ever noticed this? The Passover. Have you ever thought about the Passover for animals? Ever heard that preached on? On the same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals. Just assumed. Of course the animals are bound up in this. So the animals are judged, the animals are also rescued, where the blood is painted over the doors. You get it in the story of Jonah. God's concerned about the animals in Nineveh. The animals matter. So what I'm saying is that animal suffering and death, and here I'm not talking about amoeba, I'm talking about what we might call higher animals, animals that are capable of suffering. And I'm saying that animal death has come in with human sin. And that has massive implications for the science. Because when you dig up the rocks underneath us, you discover there's an awful lot of diseased animals. You discover that there's an awful lot of animals that have died in horrible ways. And there's miles of rock with these animals in it. Okay? So, if I'm saying that this death and suffering animals has come after Adam's sin, then these rocks must be younger than Adam. In other words, you can't have this scenario. You can't have Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden saying, what a perfect world, isn't it just so good, just like God said, standing on top of miles of rock containing all these suffering animals. That scenario cannot work if we're saying that animal death has come from human sin. In other words, all of these rocks must be younger than Adam. So my argument for a young earth or for young fossils doesn't depend on how long the days are. I do believe they're 24-hour days. I think there's good reasons for saying that, but it's not the biggest thing in the world. What it does depend on is this. It's how we understand death. That is where I get my belief in the earth, or at least the fossil-bearing rocks, being young. And that obviously has some big scientific implications. And what I want to sort of leave you with is that if we consider we have these sort of two options, both of them have problems. If you're saying that death has come from sin, which is what I think the Bible teaches, you do have this problem. You have got to challenge the scientific consensus. You do have to find a new scientific model of Earth history. But actually, that's rather fun. That's actually something that we can grapple with and we can do. Those problems with suffering are not the sort of thing that more research is going to answer. Scientific questions can be addressed with more research. And one of the things we want to do at Biblical Creation Trust is very much be working with students. We want to, if any of you have studied in these areas or got any interest in this, we'd love to hear from you, because we want to help train up Christians to be able to use their expertise to precisely do that. If death has always been present, you've also got a problem. You can say, oh, I don't have to worry about all those scientists. But you've got another problem. You've got those pastoral and apologetic problems we've talked about. You haven't really got an answer to Stephen Fry. And also, if you're not a Christian, I think you've got a problem in how you understand death. Why are we angry in the face of death? If death has just always been there, if death is just a natural part of the world, why are we angry about it? To be angry in the face of death is as irrational as a fish complaining that water is wet. Just the way it is. And I think that's a really powerful argument. Some years ago, I was helping out in a mission back in my old college. I was in a room full of atheists. I was feeling rather vulnerable, and the question came up about the age of the earth. And I thought, oh, hell, this is going to be fun. And I thought, okay, let's not let this go without a fight. So I began by trying to explain why I believe what I believe. So a sort of much shortened version of what I've just said. What I believed about death. And the fascinating thing to me was the next 20 minutes were not a discussion over radiometric dating or anything like that. It was all about how we understood death. And how far our, how we actually respond to death is consistent with our beliefs. And I think the atheists in that context were very much on the defensive. They couldn't really explain why they treated death as they did. And of course, in doing all of that, we're very much talking about the gospel. That's what the creation evolution debate is about. That is why it matters. And that is what we can talk about, even if we don't know any science. So if you want a sort of summary of what's at stake, well, it couldn't be anything bigger, could it? I mean, it's who is God? We've thought about that. Who am I? My identity depends on where I believe I've come from. Our understanding of what's gone wrong depends on how we answer these questions. How can it be put right? Our understanding of the gospel depends on this. You can't have anything much bigger than those four questions, can you? And of course, the questions, the objections that we get, so many are related to how we deal with origins. Yes, even the destruction of the Canaanites, that could have been one of the talks for tonight. That is directly related to how we think about creation, but that's for another. You can ask about that if you want.